The most recent change in Australian prime ministers apparently caused considerable embarrassment, we read, at recent global gatherings, but at the same time jolted many of us, I think, into seriously questioning the state of our modern democracy. How had it come to this? Maybe we've reached a point where problems can no longer be denied. We've just been discussing that before the news. The evidence being the recorded drastic drop in public trust in governments, the constant pleas for more competence amidst widespread voter cynicism. Even the school children are demonstrating. Then again, some astute observers have noted that solutions to problems aren't celebrated quite as much as previously either. So it's a conundrum. To a large extent, this is a global phenomenon in liberal democracies. However, in this discussion, we will try to keep the focus on the domestic. And both my guests have tried not merely to diagnose problems, but to recommend some circuit breakers, which is what attracted us. Two eloquent and experienced observers of the political process join us now as this tumultuous year winds up. Former Chief Scientist, former Vice Chancellor of the ANU, and continuously engaged observer Emeritus Professor Ian Chubb is with us in Canberra. Good morning.
Hello, Geraldine.
And in Melbourne, Professor Ken Smith. He's been a senior public servant, having led the Queensland Public Service under Premier Anna Bligh. He's now Dean and CEO of ANSOG, the Australia and New Zealand School of Government, and passionately interested in this issue. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Now, we heard, Ian Chubb, you address the National Press Club earlier this year. You were part of a group saying politics needs a reboot. Now, you've obviously been thinking a great deal about this and seeing we're trying to be constructive here rather than just list all the problems. What do you particularly recommend?
Well, I proposed a number of partial solutions, I suppose you'd call them, Geraldine, because what I can't do is wave a magic wand and get more talent, better talent, change everything about Parliament and parliamentarians as much as I'd like to. So I propose things like let's have ministers being really accountable. Let's have them express what they want to do with their ministry while they've got it and review their progress towards their goals every year, just like everybody else has to do. Pretty well everybody else has to do in Australia these days. Let's look after their accountability in the same way that we look after the accountability of other people who draw from the public purse and run it through Centrelink. Let's make sure that we just remember that these people we elect are of us. Their role is to represent us, but they are of us. They are not separate from us. They're not a separate group, a separate class, a separate ruling class. They are of us, and they should be subject to the same sorts of rules that the rest of us have.
Yes, you say, in effect, they should be held accountable to KPIs, like any manager of any business, and mm-hmm. be able to articulate the goals of their portfolios and report publicly on their progress on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. Now, as somebody suggested to me last night, sometimes you can set up KPIs. The Carr government, for instance, when it first came into power, said they were going to reduce the waiting lists in hospitals from 12 months to 6 months or whatever. And suddenly mm-hmm. you had a whole range of redesignation about what delays really meant, for instance, you know.
Yeah.
And you can be cute about this, but you think to meet the perceived target, you think it's a doable thing. You think it would prompt a different conversation, do you?
Well, I think it would, because we wouldn't have quite the avoidance of sensible answers to reasonable questions that we presently see as the norm. I mean, I guess, Geraldine, my irritation, my frustration, I suppose, has been building up over a period of time. But I focused particularly on it at the beginning of this year when I was listening to people being interviewed, ministers being interviewed as they came back to Parliament for the first sitting week. And I heard so many of them avoid perfectly reasonable questions. And I thought that, I mean, these people are working for us. We have a right to know what they're doing. We don't expect to be wading through a bucket of fog because they put one there for us to walk through. We expect clarity in answers. We expect truthfulness. We expect honesty. We expect ethics. We expect all of those things, or we should expect them. And that means we've got to engage more too.
And well, indeed, and just before I go to Ken, is it also not fair to say that there has to be community curiosity expressed via the press often in what has worked in the competence? They may feel that they're just constantly bombarded with what's wrong here, what hasn't measured up, and they're actually never asked about what has measured up.
Well, that's true, and I think we should respect it a lot more than we do. But in order to do that, we have to engage much more than we do, and that means applauding the good things, and it means criticising the bad things, and expecting more, putting high expectations on it. So I think that we should recognise when things are done, but I don't think anybody benefits when we see somebody. Reported anyway as boasting that not having lost something is a victory, and not having lost because they went home early. I mean, is that not certain to give rise to cynicism in some quarters? I would suggest that it does.
See, Ken, you write, and you gave the David Solomon lecture on this very topic earlier this year, the constant sense of managing crisis, you suggest, in say, public services, and politicians for that matter, has undermined the confidence and the capabilities of those in government. How so?
Geraldine, I think that constant pressure of dealing with the here and now doesn't allow people to step back and look at the bigger issues of how the system is operating, how they can improve public policy outcomes. The data is really clear in terms of where declines in trust is also occurring. It is at areas which are more distant from people. So I think there are some lessons there in terms of our political leaders looking to subsidiarity, to looking at
which is
how
sending
to
a decision down to the lowest possible levels to make it achieved, isn't it?
That's right. And we've had much greater centralisation in the Federation recently as our federal political system has taken over responsibility that was previously delivered at a local level. So I think that's important. I think the issue of the nature of representative democracy. I think people are looking for more, the community is looking at more deliberative and informed democratic ways of doing things. So, you know, simply going to a ballot box, electing someone for a 3 or 4 year period and then determining whether they've done a good job or not, I think is really difficult in the current environment in the way that people communicate and expect to be involved. And then there are issues around transparency to working in the public interest rather than sectional interests, making sure that the questions that people may sort of ask, and Ian has dealt with this in some of his recent speeches about particularly entitlements and the issue in integrity is not can I do this, not a rule-based issue, but should I do this? And I think there's a need to revisit some of those issues and to build institutional integrity rather than see integrity as simply the absence of corruption.
And in fact, you say that you, during the 90s and the early 2000s when you were involved in the Queensland Public Service, the Fitzgerald Inquiry, of course, was a major moment, not only for Queensland but for the whole community, I think. And you saw real changes that brought positive reform in Queensland. Can we apply anything from that experience today, do you think?
I think it's important to look at history, and obviously that was a major shock associated with institutionalized corruption that required a complete rebuilding of the system. But at the time, there were real commitments as a result of Fitzgerald to not only electoral reform, but also to significant reform in areas like freedom of information. And I believe that transparency and the importance of freedom of information really provides accountability.
I'd like you to really develop this with some specific examples that have happened overseas, because you say developing this preference for openness to cut through a culture of secrecy and a desire for non-disclosure is really important. What do you mean by that?
Oh, it's really important for good public administration, and I believe trust in public officials, that they are making decisions in an accountable way and making decisions in what their primary responsibility is, whether they're elected officials or appointed officials, is operating in the public interest rather than from a particular sectional interest. And I believe that when our political leaders and our public officials provide high quality evidentiary based advice, the advice, if it's more open and more transparent, can actually lead to the ability to convince people in the community of the need for change. An example that I'd give, we're about to, with Ian's previous university, publish a manuscript on the issue of policy successes in Australia and New Zealand. And one that is quite amazing is when the Howard government, after the awful massacre in Tasmania, implemented gun controls. And the really interesting issue, if you look at that in detail, Howard actually went against sectional interests on his own side of politics and operated in the public interest. And that the public interest was able to win in that case against some very strong sectional interests, both within that area of conservative politics, but more generally with very powerful lobby groups and within a federated system. But the change process was possible.
Yes,
because the Prime Minister took it on at the time.
And you make a very interesting example in your paper. For instance, in the USA, several states have begun collecting information about doctors' patterns of prescribing opioid pain medication. It's now made public. So doctors know about their own practices in comparison with those of their peers. And in Arizona, a pilot program has seen participating counties cut prescription rates by 10% and overdoses by 4% by actually having, if I hear you correctly, a sort of systemic release of information. Everybody knows that's what's going to happen.
That's right. I think the use of information, we've been looking at the negative implications of the powerful systems that we've got literally on our fingertips at the moment. But there is a potential for information, good quality scientific information, to improve outcomes in the community, whether it relates to that prescription drug issue in the US, or relating to how people can protect themselves in extreme weather events that we're having at the moment, in dealing with a range of health issues, communicable diseases, etc.
Let me just tell listeners, the former chief scientist, Professor Ian Chubb, and Professor Ken Smith, a long-standing, now the Dean of the Australian and New Zealand School of Government with us, a long-standing public service background with us to discuss how we can refresh our democracy. Ian Chubb, it's quite interesting to think about the role of politics. Jeff Gallop, the former West Australian Premier, wrote a very interesting piece in the online journal The Mandarin recently, which goes to public servants, about the importance of actually having political skills developed inside your public services, let alone your politicians. And he quotes an Israeli, I think it is, thinker, Alon Pellad, political skills are the secret weapon of winning leaders, and that actually you do need to help people work out how to achieve things, how to cut across sectional interests we've been talking about already today, not to decry them as sort of nefarious, but they do have to exist. Do you agree?
Oh, yes, I do. I think it's the art of getting something done, isn't it? And I mean, the context within which we operate, Geraldine, is that after any federal election, roughly half of us don't want the government that got 50-point-something% of the vote. And how you get things done in that context and how they get things done and how they work their way through it does require that level of skill all the way through their themselves and their advisory structures. So yes, I do agree.
He also talks about this phenomenon of the continuous campaigning that he assesses happens in, is perceived anyway to happen in government these days, putting even more pressure on partisanship for the public servants, so that there's a new suite of skills and savvy required if the people making our system work behind the scenes are to continue being effective.
Well, that's true too. I mean, I think it's pretty tough when you're facing ministers and indeed backbenchers, but ministers, let's say, whose primary objective is the next election, whenever that happens to be. And in Australia, on average, that's something under 3 years. So the vision is short. The ambition is to stay in power, stay in government. And that, I think, flavours too much of what we now see and do. I'm reflecting back on the John Howard and the gun control issue. One of the striking things about that from my point of view, and you know, I see these things, I don't follow them assiduously, but I remember at the time that he built a narrative. We knew why it was being done as a community, and we wanted it done by majority. Not everybody wanted it done, but he had the courage to stand up and say, well, we need to do it because it's better for Australia that we do. And he told the story. And when you look at some of the successes, it's because they come out of a narrative. They don't come out of a headline.
Mm. Well, and you're agreeing, Ken?
Yeah, I think political nous is really important. Obviously, the public service has got to operate in a bipartisan way. But picking up on what Ian said, I think part of the problem is in the absence of any real attempt to respond in an evidentiary way, and for that to be open and transparent and creating a narrative and change within the community, then you do get to a position where people you know, go into their corners and maintain a position. I mean, Ian, again, just reading your National Press Club speech where you refer to, you know, the issues of climate change and the public position on those issues, and clarity of the public view is very different from a view which is a you know, very marginal view in the political spectrum.
Look, given we've only got a couple of minutes left, you do two things. Can you say? You recommend sabbaticals as a vital need, not seen as something where you just take a break, in order to allow people time to deliberate. You use this word deliberate. You think that there's precious little deliberation underway in governance circles these days.
That's right. I think too many of us have been really responding to the crisis. We've been reading newspapers, we've been taking briefs, we've been involved in a range of activities, but very rarely stepping back, thinking, deliberating, and working on some of the bigger solutions to issues that require the narrative, as Ian said, to go out and work with the community where change or a different position may be required. And again, if I could refer to a great policy success in Australia, it was when both Neil Blewett and Peter Boehm, in a bipartisan way, came together on Australia's very successful HIV/AIDS strategy, implemented issues that couldn't have been thought about before, like needle exchange, based on an approach to dealing with an issue that had to get a different policy solution. And so when the political system at its best can do that, it can actually deal with quite significant issues and actually have very positive impacts on the community overall.
A final word to you, Ian Chubb. Can specifically, other than your KPI suggestion, can you sort of offer something that is achievable? Is achievable, because it does feel pretty crisis-ridden at the moment.
I think the thing that I'd like to see, Geraldine, is much more engagement from the community. I mean, the thing that surprised me when I looked at it was that something like to the order of 2.5 million of us didn't bother to participate in the last election. And we have a compulsory voting system, and yet there were roughly 1.5 million people who didn't bother, who were registered, and 800,000 who could register who hadn't bothered. So I'd like to see much more engagement from the community, because we will only get change when we as a community demand it, I believe. And we can only do that by engaging with the process, engaging with the system, and being clear about what we want and what we expect, and being prepared to celebrate successes, but at the same time making clear what our view of what the country needs is and how it should be delivered.
A very interesting feedback we're getting from the text line. Of course, one text said the gun issue that we talked about had shock and fear supporting it, which is true. It was a full-on crisis, and it did focus the mind. Look, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I mean, we won't solve it all, but at least we hope it's a start. So, Professor Ian Chubb, thank you to you.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And Professor Ken Smith, thank you to you.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And happy Christmas to you both.